This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My first guest, Pamela Adlon, co-created with Louis C.K. a new comedy series on FX that premiered Thursday called Better Things. It stars Adlon in a role drawn from her own life as an actress and voiceover artist who is also a single mother of three girls. Two of them are teenagers. So in the series, she's doing her best to maintain her career while trying to do right by her kids, who often resist her and create mayhem. Fans of Louis C.K.'s series Louis will know Adlon as his friend and sometimes girlfriend, Pamela. Adlon was also a writer and producer of that show and played Louis's wife on his first series, Lucky Louis. She won an Emmy for her voice work in the animated series King of the Hill as the adolescent boy Bobby Hill. She's also done a lot of other work for cartoons and played Marcy Runkle on Showtime's TV series Californication. Let's start with the opening scene from the premiere of Better Things. Adlon's character, Sam, is at a shopping mall with her youngest daughter, who's around 9. Sam is sitting on a bench, looking at her phone, and kind of ignoring her daughter, who's crying and tugging at Sam's arm. A woman sitting at the other end of the bench is staring at Sam disapprovingly. Sam looks at the woman and says this.
Hi. Do you want to buy her the earrings? Because that's why she's crying, because of $6 earrings that she has them at home already. But she wants them for right now, so you should go into that store and buy them for her. Because I'm not doing it. Or stop looking. You want a hot dog on a stick?
Pamela Adlon, welcome to Fresh Air.
So thank you.
I'm sure a lot of this series comes out of your life. And I'm sure, like probably all mothers, you've been in the position of feeling like you're being judged by somebody you don't know because your child is crying and they think that you're being cruel to her.
Yeah, oh, yeah. That was just a fatal thing that happened to me when I was a new mom. And I just always was trying to, you know, compare myself to other people and, you know, feeling insecure about, you know, my kids or what they were doing or how I was being, you know, looked at.
And how did you get over that?
I had two more. Survival and realizing that, you know, just I don't need to be a room mom every freaking year in school. It's fine.
So in a way, the audience for your show is going to be like the woman on the bench watching you and your kids or your character and your character's kids. And are you worried that we'll all be passing judgment on your parenting based on the series?
That's funny. No, I'm not worried. I'm not worried at all. I'm proud of it, extremely proud of it. And also, I feel like it's inspiring when you see somebody do something that's complicated. So I feel like we're helping people. That's what I'm hoping for.
You know how a lot of presidential candidates say before they decide to run for office that they have to talk with their family and take a vote in the family about whether they should run or not?
Oh, I should have done that.
did you put this to a vote with your children about whether it was a good idea for you to play a mother with three children, similar to the fact that you have three children?
At first, I was being very protective of them in terms of what I was doing and the material. I was guarding the project, and I was guarding my actual children so that my kids didn't feel like they were being co-opted or that anything was besting them, you know? But eventually they started getting involved, and they helped me cast the girls, and they put their votes in, and I would run material by them that was appropriate. And they're very much a part of it. The show is completely dedicated to them and all that they do, and the show really gives them a voice and their friends. You know, it's an incredible gift that I've been given.
So let's hear another scene from the first episode of Better Things. And in this scene, you're in the car with your oldest daughter, who's 15. Her name is Max, and she's played by Mikey Madison. And so out of the blue, she tells you that she wishes you smoked pot.
I wish you smoked pot, Mom.
What?
It would be good for you. Stoners aren't losers, Mom. And it would mellow you out.
I'm perfectly mellow.
Can I ask you something? No. You know what? Never mind. You'll just freak out.
Okay, you don't have to, but now you know you're going to.
Could you get pot for me?
What?
Gabby Schuster's mom told her if she ever wanted to smoke pot, she'd get it for her. Like, don't you want me to have clean, organic pot? You should want me to have good nugs.
Good nugs? I don't even know what to say. That's amazing. I don't know how to get pot. I don't even know where to get... Gabby Schuster's mom said that to you? Okay, that's great. I can't even get grand pot for her arthritis. How about this? How about this? No. No, Max, I'm not going to get you pot.
It's so easy,
Sorry.
Mom. You get a prescription. You just have to be 18.
Max, honey, can we just go back to the regular hard things like school supplies?
You should be happy I'm honest with you. I could just get it and not tell you.
Oh, yeah. Well, that might be a little better.
Seriously?
Yeah. These things are normal, but you should be ashamed of them.
Why? You're my mom. I want you to know if I have sex or if I want to get high.
Ah, no, hide things from me, please.
That's hilarious. So tell us about writing that scene.
Well, that scene might not have been so difficult to write.
Because?
No names. In terms of telling these stories developmentally, this is something that was going on with a lot of kids around my daughters and my friends' kids. And so I wanted to kind of, show what happens when there is an open dialogue and maybe the parent doesn't want it to be so open. It's a little scary.
I love the way the daughter is using both guilt and a sense of parental duty to try to get you, the parent, to,
works
to,
every time.
To buy a pot for her.
Works every time. It's your duty to give me something that's clean for my body, which I'm probably going to do anyway. No, please don't put that on me.
You know, in this series, the daughters, the two older daughters, just really speak so rudely to the mother. I mean, they insult her. They totally mess up the house when she's away and don't even bother to clean it up. Would you let your kids talk to you that way or get away with that kind of thing at home?
Would I let them?
Okay, that's the thing, right. Can you stop them?
Yeah, it's... I used to say to my girls, oh my God, if my father were here and
yes,
you were me, you would get, a belt, a spanking, and they just look at me like, are you insane? Do you think that means anything to me? It's just like such empty threats. When the kids are like, fine, put me in a timeout. Then they get too old for timeouts. What do? Take away their computer. You can't take away my computer, Mom. I have so much homework and it's all on the internet, which is true. I mean, they get you on every level. It's maddening.
So give us a sense of what the process was. When you and Louis decided to start this new series, Better Things, where did you start? Like, what were the first questions you had to ask yourself?
Well, I found myself really just not being motivated to write for myself. I'm kind of more like a team player and a supporter. So it was fairly easy for me to come up with ideas for Louis for his show and things like that. But I, you know, when it came to me talking about my show, like I said, I was like, okay, let's make another kind of profession. And maybe I have like a Chinese daughter and, you know, like a son from Africa.
Were you just assuming that your own life is boring and therefore you can't draw from it? Other people's lives?
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. You know, it's just one of those things. You're like, what? But, you know, at the same time, you know, my life is extraordinary because it's so normal, but it's so extra for some reason. You know, I always would get a sense like when my daughters and I are together and we're walking, it sometimes feels in my head like we're Reservoir Dogs. It's just the four of us, you know, and I see it in slow motion and, you know, and it they're completely captivating, my daughters. And they're all individuals and they're just incredible. And their story's incredible. And so interesting to me to tell the story about three girls at different stages developmentally, not really put into the conversation, where's the dad? You know, because that's not really the story to me. The story is this family. This is what this family is. And, you know, it's just this one woman who has no zone defense raising these three girls. And then there's the mom, you know, her mother who lives across the street. So coming up with that concept was, you know, kind of a lightning bolt, like dummy, just write what you know. And then, you know, Louis and I used to always, and we still do writing exercises together. So we said to each other, okay, I said, I've got an assignment. You write a scene that you think sounds like the voice of my show, and I'm going to write a scene. And let's call each other at the end of the day and read our scenes to each other. And so that's what we did. And he wrote a scene that was, you know, me in the park at soccer, and I pick up a kid and in the van full of kids, and we turn around and nobody knows who this kid is. And it was funny and everything. And I wrote a scene for a bunch of my girlfriends, like a girls' night out, which really had nothing to do with there were no kids in the scene, but there were mothers in the scene. And so we read them to each other, and he said to me, that's it. That's the voice of your show. You keep going in that direction. And so I just kept writing scenes, essentially. And a thing that Louis always said to me is, forget about story. Forget about story. Put that out of your head right now. You just keep writing. And I mean, you know, I am the daughter of a writer, and you know, and I grew up as an actor, but my writing voice was really nurtured and guided by working with Louis all these years.
Why was he telling you to forget about story?
Because it would be like, you know, instead of saying, okay, this episode is about Sam has a problem at the dentist, and then she goes to the thing, and then her daughter comes and says something. That's not the way we write. It's just about elements and details and then putting it together. And then when I have all these wonderful scenes and scenarios, then I put them together and a story becomes itself.
Yeah, the child goes to the dentist and mayhem ensues is your standard blurb, episode blurb on an old school network sitcom.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, but it was very valuable. It was a huge thing for me to realize that, you know, because I would say, what happens here? What happens here? Okay, just forget about that. What's the next thing that happens in her day?
Mm-hmm.
Or what's the next thing that happens, you know, to the kids? And this is the way this show got created. It's just, for me, it was a very organic kind of, you know, non-formatted way to create something.
Your character in the series is an actress and voiceover artist, and you've done a lot of voiceover work. When did you realize you could do voices? You've done a lot of, you know, cartoons as well as, I think, advertisements, you know, commercials.
Yeah, it's funny because I tracked it to one of the first times we came to California. One of my dad's, like, cronies had this recording studio, and he needed a little girl to do a radio spot for him. So he asked my dad to bring me in when we were here in California visiting, and I did like a little voiceover for something, and I played a valley girl, which I didn't even know what that was. And then I guess I started to I somehow got cast in a commercial, and I didn't have a commercial agent as a, you know, I did when I was a little girl, but I didn't later in my teens and my 20s. And somehow I got cast in a Jack in the Box commercial, and I ended up doing it, and I did one of those, you know, I coined a phrase in the commercial. It was like, where's the beef? But I said, I told those guys, do it with chicken. Now people are going to look that up. This sucks. So anyway, I was really excited to do it because William Fraker, the great cinematographer, shot that commercial. So a man named Paul Doherty, who's with Cunningham, CESD, I can't say all the names. He heard my voice and he brought me in and he said, read this copy. And I said, but this is for a boy. And he said, just trust me, read it. And it was a 7-Eleven spot. And I was to play this boy, Kevin, talking to his dad. And so he said, okay, you're great. I'd like to represent you. And so he sent my audition out and I booked it. And it was the first thing, and it was this 7-Eleven campaign that went on for several years. And I just worked in radio for a long time, and I knew about animation, but I just could not get my foot in the door. And then I finally started booking some animation jobs, and I just, that was heaven. It was heaven. I did, you know, did a bunch of Rugrats back in the day, and I would look at E.G. Daily and, you know, Cree Summer and Chris Kavanaugh, rest her soul, and Kath Soucie, and I would be like, oh my God, this is my jam. I gotta do this. And so I started doing animation. Then I could not get arrested in radio anymore. It seems like you either do one thing or the other. I don't know too many people who can cross over.
When you say radio, do you mean radio ads?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So how did you find the voices that you're capable of getting for animation?
There's something in my voice tonally that's like a boy. So, you know, I started, you know, being able to do boy voices and to be known as having a naturalistic boy tone without pushing it, like, you know, like from the old days, like, you know, like the Rankin Bass boys who would be like, gee, Mom, I have a lollipop. Although I do some of those sometimes, but, you know, I just started to kind of, I would say they would call me the cleaner because, like, I would replace boys who were real adolescents and their voices completely changed and they couldn't do the voices anymore. And you know, it was great. It's just one thing led to another. And then I was, you know, at 20th Century Fox one day and I walked in and it was just a regular voiceover audition and they handed me the sides. They said he's a 12-year-old boy from Texas. And I was like, ah, man, I wish I'd watched Badlands last night or some reference, something in my brain. But, you know, I went for it. And then, you know, I went back and I remember auditioning for Greg Daniels and there were all these sketches on the wall. And he said, I hope you don't think I'm rude, but I'm going to turn away from you and I'm going to look at the sketch of Bobby Hill while I'm listening to you. And so that pretty much was it for me.
This is Bobby Hill and King of the Hill, which was on, right. I don't know, for like 12 years or something. I was on a really long time.
Yeah, we did 13. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And, so, and your voice, as far as I could tell, kind of stayed the same during those years.
Yeah. Well, I didn't go through puberty.
Yeah, well.
Been there, done that.
But voices do tend to get older.
I went through pregnancies.
Yeah, that's true.
I went through 3 pregnancies as Bobby.
Wow.
Yeah. It's something else.
We do a little Bobby really voice is. For us?
Well, Terry, I just want you to know that I admire you so much, and I would like to take you to Benihana if you ever come to Hollywood.
So what Texas accent did you find for that, since you hadn't watched Badlands the night before the audition?
You know, I was just like, okay, you know, one of those.
I feel like, you know, in terms of dialects, my mother used to always, when she would tuck me in, I would ask her to do different dialects. Because she's English, she would do Scottish and English and Irish and Australian. And it was one of my favorite things that she would do for me. And she would say the name of the world's, the longest name of a town in the world, which is like in Dublin or something, like Clamfair Prithwingeth Quingereth Quingoch Clandithiliath Gogogoch, something like that. And she would just do things like that for me. And I am convinced now that that's what planted that seed.
So when did you become a single mother?
Oh, boy. How far back do I go? You mean, when did I get divorced?
You felt kind of single mother beforehand?
Yeah, sometimes, sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been since 2009.
So how old are your kids now?
They're all teenagers. Got a 19, 16, and 13-year-old. Girls.
Wow.
Not for the faint of heart. Do not enter. Enter at your own risk.
Well, I want to wish you good luck with the series. I think it's great. And
Thank you so much.
So glad you have it. It's been great to
Thank
talk you with you
so
again.
Thank you so much.
Pamela Adlon stars in the new series Better Things, which she created with Louis C.K. It premiered Thursday night on FX. It's been 11 years since Jonathan Safran Foer published his last novel, the award-winning 9/11-inspired story, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. This was the week that many of Foer's readers have been waiting for. His third novel, Here I Am, has just been published. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review.
Dazzling and draining. Dazzling and draining. That's how my response seesawed. For most of the time, I was reading Jonathan Safran Foer's new novel, until the last 100 pages or so brought home the final verdict. Just dazzling. Foer's novel is called Here I Am, and it's a long and very dense novel about a marriage and family falling apart, a personal disaster paralleled on a grand scale by a catastrophic earthquake in the Middle East that propels Israel and the Arab world into near Armageddon. Foer's title, Here I Am, is taken from one of the most disturbing passages in the Bible, where God commands Abraham to sacrifice his beloved son, Isaac. That passage begins when God calls out to Abraham, and Abraham answers, Hineni, here I am. The core question that Foer's novel explores is to whom do we respond, here I am, when called? Our families, our religious communities, our country? Who or what do we show up for? Here I Am takes place over 4 weeks in the life of the Block family, who live in Washington, D.C. Jacob is a novelist turned television screenwriter. Julia is an architect. They have 3 sons, the eldest of which, Sam, is about to make his bar mitzvah, or that is, he will, if he apologizes for the list of racial epithets he scrawled on his desk at Hebrew school. Jacob and Julia are shocked. They're the kind of enlightened liberals who talk openly and exhaustively with their kids, eat pretentious pasta, and yes, always have NPR on in the car. Sam's offensive list, however, will soon be augmented by another damaging string of words when Julia finds a cell phone hidden at home, never a good discovery. Sure enough, the phone turns out to contain erotic text messages that Jacob has exchanged with another woman. The Blocks marriage fractures. That summary of the opening pages of Here I Am does almost nothing to give you a sense of the frenzied atmosphere of this novel. Four chronicles the parallel disintegrations of the Block family and the Middle East through an array of voices, memories, leaps into the future, and pages-long catalogs. He riffs on everything from the contents of the Block's medicine cabinet to the old-fashioned and now unpopular names on the headstones in a Jewish cemetery, names like Pincus, Beryl, Jaime, and Wolf. Four's tone is constantly slip-sliding from melancholy to comedy, as in a brilliant scene in an airport bathroom where Jacob spots Steven Spielberg at the urinal beside him and notices, to his dismay, that Spielberg appears to be uncircumcised. As Four keeps reminding us, Judaism has a special relationship with words, and he embraces his logophilic legacy here with gusto. But it's also extremely loud and incredibly close, and we readers are asked to stop and applaud so many virtuoso set pieces that the novel is, yes, draining and dazzling. There are many provocative commentaries here, for instance, on political commitment and Jewish identity, particularly when Jacob's Israeli cousin, Tamir, comes to D.C. for a visit. The cousins' life histories are contrasted this way. Tamir had fought for his homeland, while Jacob spent entire nights debating whether that stupid New Yorker poster, where New York is bigger than everything else, would look better on this wall or that one. Tamir tried not to get killed, while Jacob tried not to die of boredom. And yet, as absorbed as this novel is with those larger issues, it too, like Jacob, privileges the personal over the political. Four takes us deep into the despair that marks the crumbling of the Block family. For instance, in the middle of his first tense conversation with Julia, after the discovery of that cell phone, Jacob thinks these words to himself, a spare elegy on the end of a marriage. So many days in their shared life, so many experiences. How had they managed to spend the previous 16 years unlearning each other? How had all the presence summed to disappearance? Here I Am is a profound novel about the claims of history, identity, family, and the burdens of a broken world that weigh upon even the most cleverly evasive people. As the great boxer Joe Louis said about one of his savviest opponents, he can run, but he can't hide. Nor can any of us.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Here I Am by Jonathan Safran Foer. My next guest, Nels Klein, is best known as a guitarist in the indie rock band Wilco. He brought a more experimental sound to the band, adding the kind of feedback, distortion, and noise that he's explored in the avant-garde groups he's led. In 2007, Rolling Stone named him one of 20 new guitar gods, and in 2011, he made the magazine's list of the 100 greatest guitarists of all time. Nels Klein's new album is a departure. It's a collection of lushly arranged versions of American popular song, covers of more recent songs, including one by Sonic Youth, and originals. The album is called Lovers. The arrangements are by Michael Leonard, and the album features 23 musicians, including Klein's wife, Yuka Honda, who's in the band Chibomato, and his twin brother, drummer Alex Klein. Let's start with a track from the new album. This is Glad to Be Unhappy. Nels Klein, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me ask you to describe the concept of your new album, Lovers.
Well, it's something that I've been pondering and dreaming about for, well, maybe over 25 years, certainly. It's about maybe my idea of a mood music record, but not a cheesy one. It's an attempt to show feelings, update, and be more thorough the idea of romance, sexuality, intimacy, and how that relates to songs. Not to say that I have achieved that, but I am aspiring to that.
So let's talk about your work with Wilco. I know there's a lot of Wilco fans in our audience. You joined the band in 2004. What stage was the band in, you know, musically and personally when you joined?
Well, I didn't know personally anything about these guys. And I could say that when I joined Wilco, there was some drama. Jeff was unbeknownst to me, going through some real problems with prescription painkiller addiction. So right when I joined, we were going to go on tour, he went into a hospital and basically got clean. And the tour was canceled, and people were really worried that I had hitched my wagon to some sort of dysfunctional vehicle. But in reality, it's quite the opposite. I had total faith in Jeff, and my faith was well-placed. You know, we soldiered on. He's been completely cool. He even quit smoking many, many years ago, and 12 years have gone by of solid music making with the same six dudes. It's really, really been amazing.
Yeah, you mentioned that Jeff Tweedy went to rehab for a prescription painkiller addiction. You know, I know he's had to deal with depression, panic attacks, and stage fright, too. And I'm wondering if he still has, I don't know if you're comfortable talking about this, but if he still has to deal with stage fright, and what's that like for you? Because everybody probably gets a little bit nervous, at least before a big performance. But, you know, he's the front man, so you want him to be in a good space.
Jeff is, I think, found a proper way to deal with things with some kind of medication. I don't know what it is that's very effective. And I think the stage fright thing is not such a big deal. But then again, maybe he just makes it look easy, because we really just are very relaxed before the shows, and he's doing great. I think even the migraines, which I think was a really big problem for him, only rear their ugly head once in a while at this point. And that can be, of course, debilitating. But overall, he's a really functional and very solid and at this point, insanely prolific artist.
So let's play something from the new Wilco album, Wilco Schmilco. Who came up with that title?
Jeff.
Okay.
It's very Jeff.
What inspired that, do you know?
Well, I guess it's Nilsson Schmilsson, you know, I really was surprised. That was the working title all along, working on the record, but I was pretty surprised that it stuck, you know. The previous record is Star Wars, which is another hilarious Jeff title.
I'm going to play a track from the new album, Wilco Schmilco, and you and Jeff Tweedy are both playing guitar on this, so tell us what to listen for, like which part's you, which part's Jeff Tweedy, and what are you doing? Because it sounds like the guitar is like detuned on it.
Yes, I'm not exactly sure what the original first piece of this song was, or where it originated, I should say, because a lot of times Jeff records stuff on his phone when he's on tour. And I think this possibly is one of the tracks that emerged from his iPhone. And then we start playing along with it. And quite often, as you'll hear on other tracks from Wilco Schmilco, we're not in 440 or 442 pitch, because Jeff was he hadn't tuned his guitar to that when he recorded some idea that he had. And I think this is an example of that, where there are many textures from the guitars, acoustic and electric. I'm playing a prepared acoustic guitar with alligator clips. I believe that it was an acoustic guitar with a pickup in it, so we amplified it through a small guitar amp and recorded it acoustically in order to bring out some of the microtonal overtones. And this way you could probably liken it to maybe Fred Frith's work in the 70s or even John Cage prepared piano with the erasers and whatnot.
Yeah, and just to clarify for people who don't know, prepared piano and erasers means you're sticking the erasers in the piano strings to distort correct. The sound. When you're preparing your guitar with the alligator clips, where are the alligator clips?
You can put them anywhere they sound good, but I generally prefer to start over the sound hole area of an acoustic guitar. Clip right on the strings. So that's what you're hearing me do on this. There is electric guitar where you hear the fast tremolo picking guitar in the middle with the weird hand claps and all that stuff. That's me and Jeff. Just going kind of crazy. I'm not sure that we were thinking about the harmonic content at that point. I think we were just kind of moving around, and I was following his lead. And Glenn, I think, is doing some kind of strange, some sort of stick technique where he's vibrating a thin stick against the rim of one of his drums. There's a lot going on there, Terry. We haven't figured out how to play this song live yet.
But I want to get back to the phone. So Jeff Tweedy records something on his phone, and then you're playing with a phone recording that he's made while he was on the road?
Yes, sometimes.
So part of what we're hearing is what he recorded on his phone?
I think on this track, as I recall, it's probably from a phone recording initially, and we play along with it in the loft, in the recording facility in the loft.
So you're listening to it on headphones as you play?
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah, you never know how a song is going to come together with Wilco, I'll tell you.
Okay. So let's hear how it came together. This is from the new Wilco album, Wilco Schmilko. This is Common Sense.
I slammed my finger in the door of love. Goddamn the judging, stranger judge.
What did Wilco bring out in your playing? Like, how did you adjust yourself to find the right sound for Wilco?
It's actually kind of interesting that I think primarily my goal was not to bring my personality as a whatever, you know, jazz type, soundscape type person to the band, but that kind of ended up happening. I feel that mostly the Wilco songbook kind of brought out my sort of 14-year-old aesthetic self, the rock and roll obsessive that was listening ardently to Buffalo Springfield and the Byrds and the Beatles and Rolling Stones, that music that I grew up with. And interestingly, I think trying to channel either my initial idol Jimi Hendrix or trying to fake some Clarence White or, you know what I mean, some great Glen Campbell stuff or something. And then Jeff has to tell me sometimes, you know, you're being too reverent to this material. And sometimes I think he wants me to destroy the song, as he did on a song like Dawned on Me, where I think I was trying to come up with some little jingle jangly thing. And while I was messing around, I was strangulating my 60s guitar and with an amp that was basically, I blew up the amp doing this, and he said, that's the sound that should be in the solo section. So, I mean, that would not have been my first impulse, and I think that people think it is, that my whole raison d'etre is to bring some sort of chaotic sound design to Wilco's ensemble sound, but it wasn't. I really enjoy addressing this more classicist aspect of popular music, whether it's country, folk, or rock and roll, and just trying to make the song sound like the song should sound. You know what I mean? It's not all about some kind of avant-garde mindset or about changing the sound of the band or bringing whatever my thing is into it, because I really don't think I have a thing when it comes to music. I think I want the music to sound like it should sound to everyone in the band, and then particularly to Jeff if he wrote the song. That's what's successful to me.
Did you have to find not only like a music space for yourself within the band Wilco, but also like an on-stage personality to have? Because let's face it, the smaller, more avant-garde groups that you play with probably play in like small clubs and small performance spaces where everybody's wearing a t-shirt. And granted, you all wear t-shirts on stage anyways, but you know
not
what I mean?
Me.
Oh, not you. But those small spaces, I mean, it's just different than being in like a really big theater or an arena.
It's sort of, this is going to sound maybe a little like I'm kind of not telling the truth, but I am telling the truth. I don't really care how many people are there, and I kind of play the same no matter what. But yes, rock and roll has pageantry, I like to call it.
Yeah, exactly,
In Wilco, yeah, we have lights. We have atmosphere. We have, you know, fake smoke, all that stuff that rock bands
do. You
do
the fake smoke thing?
Well, light designers insist on it so they get definition from the way the lights look. It's just a thing. We don't do like fog, like dry ice fog, like The Cure or something. But you know, I was playing rock and roll with Mike Watt and in the 90s with the Geraldine Fibbers. And when I play rock and roll, I move around a lot and I just do, you know, and when I play with Julian Lage, I'm sitting down, you know, I just like to do all these different things. And my concentration and my, I have to say, my dedication to the moment and to the sound is the same no matter what I'm doing. And I think without sounding disingenuous, I get a kind of fundamental, if not moronic, pleasure from sound as soon as it starts. So even in sound checks, once we start playing, I'm in the zone. I'm happy, you know, because I like playing and I like sound and I like all different kinds of sounds. And that is what drives me. And that's what's probably saved me.
So when you're soloing, is there a time limit on your solo? Like, especially for recordings, you know, does Jeff Tweedy say, okay, like no more than 35 seconds?
Well, the song form is usually kind of set, except on Art of Almost from the record The Whole Love, where he basically created a coda that we played separately and edited on to the end of the song. So I would, as he put it, shred. So he asked me to shred, and I think that the length of that was determined prior to my shredding, but it could have been longer or shorter if I'd wanted it to be. You know, other songs, like, you know, I just mentioned Dawned on Me, that solo section, which is just shrill noise at this point on the recording, is of a set length. And I find that this is a huge challenge for me. I start thinking about people like George Harrison when I'm given this little space of maybe 10 seconds or 15 seconds to do something, you know, beautiful, coherent, exciting, whatever is required, because I am not good at self-editing. So it's a really, really a great challenge, and it varies from song to song.
Well, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Why don't we hear the song that you were referring to, Dawned on Me? So this is Wilco with my guest Nels Cline on guitar.
Sometimes I can't believe
Niels Klein's new album is called Lovers. He's also on the new album Wilco Schmilko. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.